B. Betrayal in the relationship. C. Consensual agreement about emotional and sexual exclusivity has been broken. Discoveries are what you find. Disclosures are what you're told. Research shows that women who experience disclosures in which bits and pieces of news and half-truths are given over time show symptoms of post-traumatic stress. We're impacted each time a new piece of information comes to light. One betrayed wife, a dog breeder, said it best. When I asked my husband, "Is this everything? Is there something else you're lying to me about?" He said, "No." 2 weeks later, I found out there was more. It was like cutting off a dog's tail 1 inch at a time. The wounds of sexual deception need cleaning. The way a disclosure is done has everything to do with how people heal. Jamie is a nurse who specializes in critical wound care. Over the years, we've compared notes about physical and emotional wounds in light of how healing happens. One day, Jamie started telling me about a medical process called debridement that's used to clean out dead tissue and bacteria from grimly infected sores. Jamie shared, if the wound isn't cleaned out right, the healing stops. In fact, the wound gets worse. Hidden infections grow, and there's a risk of permanent damage. I often let the patient know the wound seems larger after treatment. It can frighten them if I don't. Cleaning out the debris gives the wound the best chance to heal. That sounds just like what happens when I'm working with a couple on their full disclosure. No one really wants to do it. But if the husband doesn't come clean, the deception infection and the pain from the betrayals continues to fester. His unconfessed shame keeps him in hiding and emotionally distant. While recovery is not a perfect path and failures in sobriety happen while they're recovering, husbands and wives often agree on a 48-hour disclosure rule to encourage truth-telling. Garth had 48 hours to let me know he broke his sobriety. We'd agreed I wanted to know what happened if his sobriety date was reset. In the beginning, that date meant everything to me. It stood for safety and hard work. 4 years later, it still does. Garth's recovery was anything but perfect. It's been the biggest fight of his life. I find myself fearing his breaches in sobriety less and trusting his honesty more. We've come a long way, and my hope is being restored. Linda. The Hebrew word picture for lust, ava, is the strong nail that hooks you to itself. In contrast to the ancient Hebrew inscription for hope, kave, which is what comes after the nail. Over time, as Garth worked through his recovery program and took responsibility for any breaches in his sexual sobriety, it brought Linda hope. He was unhooking himself by reaching out to his sponsor, 12-step group members, and trusted confidants to talk about what happened and get focused on a program for relapse prevention. In those 48 hours, Garth was able to get honest and process his feelings while disclosing what happened to Linda. Staying honest helped Garth and Linda rebuild trust. 10 suggestions for a partner-sensitive full disclosure. The goal of a therapeutic disclosure is to provide you with an account of all sexual behaviors that have broken fidelity in your relationship. Here's a list of 10 things to help guide your disclosure process. 1. It's not one thing. A therapeutic full disclosure is a part of a healing journey. It's important that the betraying spouse is involved in consistent recovery work, like a 12-step essay, SAA attendance, personal therapy, trauma treatment, and couples work. These are steps a husband follows when he's willing to do whatever it takes to help you heal. We need to find support as well. POSA, P-O-S-A, CODA, C-O-D-A, COSA, COSA, S-Anon, Al-Anon, or 12-step recovery groups, personal therapy, trauma recovery, and couples work. It's not necessary to do everything at the same time. Choose what you can. It's critical we develop a strong support base before the disclosure. I've provided some resources at the end of the audiobook to guide you. 2. Pick your surgeon. How many of us would choose a brain surgeon who's never opened a skull? None of us, I'm sure. While there are many gifted healers, I recommend a full disclosure be done with a professional therapist, counselor, or clergy person who has specialized training in what's current with the therapeutic disclosure process. It's not uncommon for the wife and the husband to have their own therapist while working through a disclosure. It can create safety for the husband to bring his sexual secrets forward. It also creates safety for a wife who might otherwise feel betrayed by a therapist who, because of confidentiality, keeps sexual secrets from her. If professionals are wisely chosen and disclosures are done effectively, they can save you time and money and give your relationship its best chance at restoration. 3. There's a game plan. You can work with your therapist to discuss what you'd like addressed during the disclosure. Do you want a brief history of sexual acting out before or after your relationship started? You get to choose. You might find it helpful to hear your husband's sexual story starting in early childhood. This helps build compassion and lifts false ideas that his sexual struggles started with you. Do you want a polygraph before going through your full disclosure? You can decide that too. I recommend reading Dr. Milton Magnus's book, Stop Sex Addiction, as he commits 3 chapters to disclosures and polygraphs. When discussing polygraphs at a conference, Dr. Magnus stated, "Because of the core belief of sex addicts that people will not love me as I am, I believe it's virtually impossible to get a complete disclosure without a polygraph exam to verify that the disclosure is not just a sanitized version of the events the sex addict hopes his partner will forgive. Unless the whole truth is told, the sex addict does not have the opportunity to get free from his behaviors. And unless the addict can get honest with his partner, they do not have the opportunity of ever restoring trust in the relationship." Those are powerful words addressing the importance of a truth-telling process. Here are a few thoughts from an interview with a Fidelity polygraph examiner I've worked with, Ryan Angulo of DF Polygraph. There are different types of polygraph exams used for different purposes, criminal versus therapeutic fidelity. Finding a good examiner who is familiar with the disclosure therapy process is helpful. Polygraphs should never be about trying to fail someone. They should respectfully assist a person to enter into a truth-telling process. Polygraphs are designed to deal with absolutes, questions written to get a yes or no answer. Women often want to know, did he love the other woman? Is he really committed to this marriage? Does he really love me? Beliefs, emotions, thoughts, and intentions are too complex to be verified. It's important to have realistic expectations. Polygraphs can't answer all questions. Sometimes partners think the polygraph is going to be a tool that's going to help them know everything that's happened. I get it. They've been painfully in the dark. But the polygraph isn't designed to work that way. It can't fill in pieces and doesn't find truth on its own. I often ask betrayed partners, what is it that you want to know? Do you have any deal breakers? Typical tests are designed to ask 3 to 4 clear and direct questions. One of them being, is what you have said in this disclosure document true? With a polygraph-tested written disclosure, the betraying partner must pass before a planned face-to-face disclosure meeting occurs. If the betraying spouse fails, he and the therapist go back to work. A written disclosure is a document about the sexual acts the betraying spouse has engaged in. This can take time. It's best when he does the following. He takes ownership through I statements. He avoids denial statements like entitlement, minimization, justification, blame, rationalization, fabrication, and comparisons. He realizes the disclosure session is not the time to ask for forgiveness with statements like, I'm sorry, or I hope you forgive me. That comes at a later time. He understands it's an honest transfer of information, not a time for excuses or appeals. 4. Avoid gory details. I often talk with wives about their desire to have specific details of what occurred. What we don't realize is those gory details stay etched in our minds. Then we have our own ghastly crypt of vivid, unwanted pictures that we wish we could get rid of. The problem is, there's no bleach for the brain, and envisioning the details makes the trauma betrayal event even more difficult to overcome. Sometimes a woman's questions are about comparisons. What color hair does she have? Breast size, ethnicity. Were there sexual positions you enjoyed with her? Did you love her? Once you find out what your husband is attracted to, anyone on the street that matches that description becomes your enemy. Details like this can set up ongoing triggers. I'm appealing to your wiser self, asking for you to kindly consider protecting yourself from the gory details that may never be forgotten. 5. Basics of a disclosure document. There are a number of ways to write a disclosure. Partner-sensitive disclosures include complete honesty about what's happened without the gory details attached. Basics include sobriety date, sexual behavior timeline, types and frequency of sexual acting out behaviors, finances involved, answers to direct and specific questions you may have. A therapist can work with your husband to reveal the categories of sexual acting out behaviors mentioned in Chapter 8, such as masturbation, strip clubs, pornography, cyber sex, emotional or sexual affairs, same sex or opposite sex, and prostitutes. 6. Take your time. A typical disclosure meeting in a therapist's office can take up to 2 hours. It's normal to feel emotional as the document is read. Sometimes women feel sad, angry, and numb, or struggle to take in what they're hearing. It's okay to take notes or ask questions as needed. You may need to get up, walk around, breathe, or take a break. If both therapists are present, they will be able to pace the session and support each person. 7. Kids, cars, and self-care. Planning suggestions around the discovery session. Ask your therapist to be on call if needed. Coordinate childcare for the day or weekend. Reach out to trusted friends and support group members. Take care of your body. Take walks, drink water, and rest. Drive separately so you'll have time to process after. Spend 24 to 48 hours away from each other to feel and process what was shared. While every couple is different, planning for what you may need after the disclosure is part of self-care. 8. Sacred documents. The disclosure document is a vulnerable and confidential declaration of truth. Copies of the disclosure are not to be stored at home where children or other family members can find them. While each therapist's policies are different, a written copy often remains in their office for future review. Documents are not to be kept and used in divorce or legal proceedings. 9. Boundaries and aftercare. Scheduling a session after the disclosure is important as you begin to process the pain and define boundaries needed to secure your safety. Marital therapy may be necessary for you to talk about changes in your household. It helps to get group support and surround yourself with people who love you. 10. The big picture. Restoring a relationship comes through owning and atoning, owning the wrongs and doing what's needed to make the relationship right. A central teaching that incorporates these two principles is found in the Jewish practice of teshuva, repentance, which simply means to turn things around. This practice has several basic steps. Recognize that what you did was wrong. Reveal how you offended through confession. Regret what you did wholeheartedly. Remorse over your part by making amends. Resolve by making every effort to avoid doing it again. Refrain from doing that thing the next time you're faced with the same situation. This means accountability, recovery, and sobriety. Repair the relationship with truth, trust, and forgiveness. It's interesting how the process of repentance, teshuva, often helps to restore peace back into the relationship. The ancient Hebrew word for restore, shalom, means to make secure, to keep safe, to impart comfort, and to encourage one who is fearful by assuring them of peace. Shalom also carries the idea of compensation for an injury, to make whole or good for what was stolen or lost in a sacred trespass. These are powerful word pictures of restoration for us. It takes time for action steps like these to be incorporated into your relationship. As you deal with the impact of sexual betrayal, you will need time to process your pain and time to be restored. The full disclosure is intended to do two things: reinstate truth-telling back into the relationship and give you the opportunity to make informed decisions about what you need. Be patient with yourself as you put the pieces of your life back together again. Take time to consider your choices. The process of teshuva, repentance, and shalom, restoration, take intentionality, tremendous effort, and time. By working together and staying open to conversations with your husband, it is possible to restore your marriage to a greater level of health. Part 5. Stepping into Empowered Living. Chapter 18. Making Yourself a Guilt-Free Priority. Self-care is not a luxury item. It's an absolute necessity to heal. Sexual betrayal saps the life out of us, knocks the wind out of our sails, and turns our brains into mush. Did I miss anything? It's no wonder we're completely overwhelmed and exhausted trying to make it through the day. Think about what our lives would look like if we honored ourselves in the same way we do when we're booking an airline flight. What are the first two things we secure? Our seats and our place in line. I have yet to meet a woman who says, "Oh, don't worry about my seat. Anywhere is fine. I'll get on last and sit in the middle seat near the bathroom so everybody else will be comfortable." This is the part of the story where you hear the scratch of a needle crossing over a vinyl record. It doesn't happen. So why do we become invisible to ourselves when it comes to self-care? The culprits are negative shame beliefs like, "I'm not good enough. I can't ask for what I want. I need to take care of everyone else." Or, "I'm too needy." Sandy knew these negative beliefs all too well. Her mom was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when Sandy was 10. She became the surrogate mom for the family by cleaning house, making dinners, and tending to her three siblings. Everybody let her do it. Her father didn't hire a house cleaner or pay to have meals brought in. 4 decades later, Sandy is a conscientious and hard worker. She's exhausted after working 60 hours a week, but still doesn't know how to say no. After discovering her husband's 3-year affair, Sandy got shingles. The betrayal confirmed what Sandy already believed. Whatever I do is never enough. I've done everything for Ted, and don't ask for anything in return. I've worked full-time, cooked, cleaned, do his laundry, and have sex. What more does he want? The woman he's had the affair with is a stay-at-home mom. Really? I wish I could be that available. No matter what I do, I can't seem to make anyone happy. Sandy's world is falling apart while her body is sending up smoke signals of distress. Her trauma-induced shame beliefs of, I'm not enough, I should have done something, and I'm not in control, have been unknowingly driving her behavior for years. At 10, she couldn't say no, and has been running ragged ever since. The spin cycle. The very nature of betrayal sparks reactivity. It's trauma. We are reacting to something we didn't know was going on. Our minds, emotions, and bodies spin like a top as our world is turned upside down. Our challenge comes in finding a path to stabilize what's happening inside of us while we're dealing with the sexual chaos that's happening around us. We have to find tools that help us rest and respond. The more grounded we are, the more collected we feel on the inside. We're less reactive and more steadied and can make better choices. Finding a pause, the sila, in the midst of the chaos can help us move towards a more thoughtful, responsive place. The wisdom of sila is found 71 times in the Book of Psalms. The Psalms are power-packed with raw emotions like anger, longings, disappointment, grief, and joy. It's no wonder we can relate to them, and no surprise the writers added so many silas. A sila is a musical interlude to help us pause, think about what was just said, or watch for a visual demonstration of what's around the bend. As women impacted by betrayal, we have to keep our wits about us and watch for visual demonstrations of recovery. Remember, trust his behavior, not his words. Adding a sila, a pause in the moment, helps us see things more clearly. Without a pause, we can't find peace, and we jump from one crisis to another. A compassionate view of our reactivity requires us to look through the lens of trauma. When we are reacting to betrayal, we are often trying to be seen, be heard, get safe, and find our choices in the matter. Finding a way out of our feelings of helplessness can turn our symptoms of stress around. Let me start out by saying it's not just one thing. If getting out of a trauma-induced spin cycle were as easy as taking laundry from the dryer, we'd do it. But it's not. The layers of impact to our bodies, brains, and emotions can be so fused together that sometimes it's hard to clearly see what's going on. My motto is, whatever it takes, because we are worth being seen and heard, we deserve a choice in the matter. Your willingness to try the options presented in this chapter will help you find yourself again. Shame beliefs like, I'm not worth the time, effort, or money, or I'm not important, or I don't deserve it, rob us of what we need to heal. Self-care is an act of personal fidelity. As we take brave steps, we faithfully show up for ourselves. SOS, stepping out of the spin cycle of shame. Whether you have underlying shame from your past or betrayal-induced shame from the present, your invisible wounds need to be treated. Shame produces unwanted, self-sabotaging behaviors that cause us to relate in one of two ways. One, shame moves us into a one-down position, a victim. Two, shame moves us into a one-up position. We attempt to have power or control over others. With unhealed trauma and shame, wounded people wound people. One resource created to help people break free from the spin cycle of shame is called the Cartman Drama Triangle. Dr. Cartman's design has been around for decades and addresses the unwanted behaviors caused by underlying shame and traumatic wounds. Every one of us has to wrestle with the influence of shame at one time or another. Trauma-induced shame beliefs can play havoc in our lives, especially when we're distressed. Shame is the culprit of conflict and chaos. Ultimately, it keeps us from peace. In Chapter 7, we looked at the Hebrew word picture for peace, shalom, to destroy the authority that establishes chaos. Much like a vessel, nearly capsized at sea, when we're stuck in conflict or overwhelmed by our own shame, we get lost in the chaos and cry for help. SOS! We don't have to stay in a helpless spin cycle. We can send healthy signals to others by changing what we do and the way we relate. Let's take a look at four roles we take on when we're under the influence of shame. Victim, rescuer, offender, and entitlement. Stepping out of the spin cycle means we listen to the cry for help inside and do something different. We respond in one of four ways: responsibility, collaboration, options, and humility. By identifying the roles and power struggles we get into with others, we can learn to follow the arrows and find our path out. As we learn how to move into more responsive stances, we feel less stuck and more empowered by what we can do. The empowerment wheel is designed to help us find a way out of helplessness. Problem. When we're stuck in the victim position, we feel trapped, react, and want a path out. Fact. We have no way of controlling what another person will do. Truth. When we decide what we need to do, we get out of the victim position. Good news. There is a way out. The solution comes in changing the way we deal with conflict by learning how to responsibly move through it. Our trauma-induced shame beliefs keep us spinning on the wheel from one power struggle to another. The price we end up paying is not getting what's most needed, and we stay spun out by emotional conflict. It's possible to unhinge from the spin cycle and make choices about what we need and how we'd like to respond. Here's some common roles we all get into when there's conflict. Remember, these are roles we take on, not people. They are shame-influenced ways of being. See if any of these roles sound familiar to you. What can you do to find your way out? 1. The victim role. People in the one-down victim position often feel helpless, hopeless, fearful, and ashamed. While victims have been wounded by someone or something, their cluster of shame beliefs keep them reacting from a one-down position rather than finding a path out. They feel too overwhelmed to solve their problems, so they look for someone else to do it for them. When someone doesn't help them, they give up, blame, or expect help from others rather than choosing to take responsibility for themselves. This role can place unconscious demands on others, causing them to pull away. Trauma-induced shame beliefs include, I'm helpless or weak, I'm too needy, or I'm not in control. Stepping out of the spin cycle means we step out of the victim role, use our voices, and take responsibility for what we do or don't do. Think about these next few ideas and consider what self-care looks like for you. Determine what you need. What can you choose to get there? Use your voice to clearly communicate what you need. If no one is listening to you, pursue getting assistance for yourself. Don't let anxiety stop you. Anxiety is a normal feeling when you're facing your fears about doing something on your own. Reach out and ask for encouragement from safe and supportive others. Take thoughtful action steps towards resources and problem-solving ideas. Use the 180-degree turnaround to move your nagging neggies into truths. I am strong. I have a voice. I can learn to make choices, and I can honor what I need. I felt like I was jumping through a ring of fire when I confronted Chip with the porn I found on his computer. He was angry with me and denied it again. I knew I was right. I saw it. Finally, I showed him the proof. When I did, he owned it. He said he needed help and called a therapist. Liliana. Responsibility helps us learn to face our fears, take risks, discover our strengths, and grow from our mistakes. 2. The rescuer role. While people in this one-up enabling position may look calm and in control on the surface, inside, they're often a ball of nerves. They feel worried, panicked, and out of control, and try to manage another's problem. They feel helpless in knowing how to stop someone from hurting themselves or others. Their trauma-induced shame beliefs are often, I don't matter, or I'm not in control. Or they have guilt-inspired beliefs like, I should have done something. Many rescuers grew up in homes with insurmountable responsibility without a way out. Stepping out of the spin cycle means we stop trying to fix or enable others. Collaboration involves two people, each carrying their fair share of what's needed. Being over-responsible keeps others from learning how to own their part. Think about these ideas and consider what self-care looks like for you. What is underneath your desire to help someone with their issue? What are your vulnerable feelings? Hurt, fear, sadness, guilt, about their behaviors? You can't make choices for someone else, but you can advocate for what you need. You can begin to talk about how their choices, sexual betrayals, impact you. If someone is unwilling to work collaboratively, you can honor your need for truth, trust, and safety by establishing boundaries. Have you looked at how you might be avoiding setting boundaries or following through with consequences to avoid conflict, abandonment, or rejection? Use the 180-degree turnaround to move your nagging neggies into truths. I matter. I can learn to make choices. And I do the best I can. I was exhausted and kept worrying about Nathan's recovery. I knew I couldn't hold the marriage together for both of us. When I started some self-care, it felt really good to take care of me. Weird, but Nathan seemed more respectful. It's been a long, hard road. At dinner, we talked about things other than what we were doing to recover. It felt good to just be. Roxanne. Collaboration is a necessary aspect of life that involves negotiation and active participation. As we learn how to take care of ourselves, initiate boundaries, and release others to take ownership of their own recovery, our load is lightened. 3. The offender role. While people in this one-up position may look powerful and together on the surface, on the inside, they are often afraid, grieving, walled off by hurt, and fearful of vulnerability or losing control. Their childhood histories often include chaotic, neglectful, controlling, or abusive families. When someone is reacting in this one-up offending position, they use power, control, rage, blame, passive aggressiveness, silence, gaslighting tactics, abuse, or they withhold affection or finances. First, let me start by defining what healthy anger is. Anger is a legitimate emotion like sadness, fear, joy, or pain. Anger is a natural response to grief and loss. Anger as a fight reaction is an instinctive trauma response. Fight, flight, freeze, and fold. Righteous anger can be a motivator for addressing injustice when others are being oppressed or hurt. Anger is a legitimate emotion when you are reacting to betrayal, deception, or sexual violation. In his book, Torn Asunder, Recovering from an Extramarital Affair, Dave Carter reminds us that people don't get better until they get mad. When someone is reacting from the offender role, the potency of their anger can escalate to the point of causing harm. With great wisdom, Eleanor Roosevelt said, "Anger is only one letter short of danger." Rage is a form of anger that's harmful. Sarcasm in Greek, sarkasian, literally means the tearing of flesh like a dog. It's a cutting word, mockery, or a sneering remark. Criticism hurts others. What isn't often talked about in betrayal trauma is how intense fear and terror can unintentionally motivate someone to react in extreme yet harmful measures of self-protection. It reminds me of a time when my loyal Labrador Retriever, Bailey, was in a fight with another dog. Without thinking about it, I tried to break up the fight, and Bailey bit me. Talking about how we deal with our feelings of anger is among the more difficult conversations to have with victims of betrayal trauma. Talking about rage is never about shaming partners. It's about offering them a way out. I've had conversations with good women, well-intentioned partners who were ashamed because the police were called to their home after they became physically violent, hitting or scratching their husband, destroying vehicles, or threatening bodily harm. These women said, "I feel out of control and I don't like who I've become," or "it's not who I want to be." When I asked these women if they were physically violent prior to the sexual deception, most of them looked at me with relief and said, "No." Others shared, "I've struggled with anger for much of my life. I don't like it, and I want to change." Whether the anger started before or after the betrayal trauma, the goal is to deal with the trauma-induced shame and find a path out. Women who have experienced betrayal can feel trapped, panicked, and terrified by what they cannot control. Many have been deeply hurt in their lives and are afraid of bringing their vulnerability into a conversation. To them, vulnerability feels weak. Passive-aggressive anger or rage becomes a way of distancing themselves from their husbands to avoid being hurt. They often have shame beliefs such as, "I can't trust anyone," "I'm powerless," "it's not okay to cry," or "I'm in danger." Living with a husband who is intentionally gaslighting and deceiving you can cause you to feel crazy, angry, and enraged. Working to establish boundaries around safety means we need to look at what options are available to us. Stepping out of the spin cycle involves looking at our options rather than using insults, rage, or harm. Even though we may not realize it, we always have a choice. We can leave our home, go to a shelter, call the police, face our fear of abandonment, work towards financial freedom, leave the sexually addictive relationship, or call an abuse hotline if we need help. It's normal to feel anxious and scared about making a change. Scared doesn't always mean stop. Sometimes scared means we need to press through the fear until we get safe. Facing our fear of powerlessness can help us better advocate for ourselves or champion those who are helpless. Think about these ideas and consider what self-care looks like for you. While you can't control how someone is treating you, you always have a choice. If you feel trapped or are experiencing gaslighting, ask for help from safe people to restore your intuition, power, and ability to choose. How might you be using anger or rage to protect yourself? Do you have wounds that may need deeper healing? It can help to talk about your vulnerable feelings of hurt, fear, or sadness underneath the anger. Do you find it difficult to cry? You may be starving for comfort. Find a safe place to release your tears, be heard, and unload your feelings of loss. Explore how your fear of abandonment or powerlessness might be keeping you trauma-bonded in a toxic relationship that isn't changing. It's the Charlie Brown syndrome we talked about in Chapter 14. Use the 180-degree turnaround to move your nagging neggies into truths. I can choose whom to trust. I can make choices. I can remove myself from abusive situations. And I don't have to stay protected by anger. I can learn how to safely express my vulnerable emotions. 4. The entitlement role. While people in the one-up entitlement position may look disaffected or like they've got it all together on the outside, their shame beliefs torment them from within. They feel impotent, incapable, desperate, fearful, and ashamed. Whether pauper or royalty, they fear failure and rejection, so they surround themselves with power, pontifications, and people who will placate their demands. They may blame, disregard others, use passive-aggressive anger, or withhold affection and finances until they get what they want. Underlying shame beliefs include, I am weak or incapable. I'm not good enough. I need to be perfect and can't fail. Or I'm rejectable. Many people who struggle with entitlement grew up in families where they were idolized, ignored, abused, controlled by unrealistic expectations, or rescued from distress by an over-responsible parent. Stepping out of the spin cycle involves letting go of entitled ways of being, imposing unrealistic perceptions, showing arrogance, demanding privileges, manipulating and using others, by becoming humble. We feel dangerously exposed when we begin to unveil our imperfections or talk about how we feel weak or incapable in an area of our lives. We may use false humility to cover our shame. We expect rejection. The ancient Hebrew word pictures for humility, shock, include bow down, to lower the fence, leave no wall up between myself, others, and God. Once we come out from behind our protective walls and openly share with safe people what we're most shameful about, we're surprised when people lean in. People feel much safer to connect when we are real and begin to take ownership of how we can change ourselves. Think about these ideas and consider what self-care might look like for you. How might you be using entitlement as an unconscious way to protect yourself from being hurt again, by either past trauma or current betrayal trauma? It feels risky to be emotionally vulnerable after we've been hurt. We can get stuck in a one-up position of entitlement as a way of trying to hold on to our power. Where can you process your fears about trusting again? Is anyone trustworthy? How can you begin to take steps towards getting what you need without making unrealistic demands on others? Our husbands will never be able to repay us for the breaches of trust and damage they've caused. How might unprocessed grief and loss play a role in what you're experiencing from your husband? Use the 180-degree turnaround to move your nagging neggies into truths. I can be myself and make mistakes. I am capable and can learn. I can safely feel my vulnerable emotions. And I can choose who is safe and risk trusting again. Honesty and humility are the cornerstones of most 12-step recovery circles. These groups can help us learn to become real, honor others, face our humanity, find grace for imperfections, and respect what others may need as well. Using the empowerment wheel to clarify these four roles can help you learn to step outside of the spin cycle and try new possible solutions. It's helpful to see how our perspectives, voice, and choices can help us move out of the victim position, through conflict, and into more victorious ways of living. Beliefs, behaviors, and biology. Pamela came into my office and playfully flashed her newly manicured hot pink fingernails. See? I did my self-care today. Don't get me wrong. Having a manicure or pedicure can be a wonderful way of caring for yourself. Yet I believe the idea of self-care is often underrated and misunderstood. When it comes to healing post-traumatic stress, self-care is not an indulgence, it's a necessity. Our bodies, brains, and minds need help to calm down. They literally can't do it on their own. Some women are perplexed and wonder why self-care is so difficult. We fear being selfish instead of caring for ourselves like we would for someone we love. It might be a blocking belief that's keeping us stuck. If our shame beliefs are similar to these, we won't allow ourselves to be a priority. What we believe, we do. Shame beliefs like, I'm invisible. I don't deserve. My needs are not important. I'm not worthy of time or attention. Some of us struggle with wishing that someone would do our self-care for us. We long to be rescued, cared for, and loved. If this is true, we may have grown up with a narcissistic, negligent, unavailable, or addicted mom who didn't nurture us. Perhaps she did not or wasn't available to provide what we needed. A world of grief may be hiding beneath the very act of taking care of ourselves. Sometimes I'll have women imagine themselves as a little girl who needs a good mom to take care of her needs and nurture her. Inner child work can help us create an inner dialogue to reparent the wounded child within us by offering ourselves compassion and comfort. It helps us listen to ourselves and connect our responsible mom's heart in the here and now to care for our younger version of ourselves that desperately needs to be seen. For others, it's pure biology. Our brains and bodies have gone into crisis from post-traumatic stress and need some help to reset UGG, Amy, the CEO, and Harmony by offering them rest. Here are some ideas that can help. Deep, slow breathing. Sleep, 7 to 9 hours. Mindfulness skills and meditation. Body therapies, yoga, and stretching. Crying. I will often tell betrayed partners there are 1,000 tears inside that need to be released. Dr. William Frey, a tear expert, has identified 2 types of tears. One type is 98% water and keeps our eyes from getting dry. The other type, emotional tears, release stress hormones and toxins when we cry. Endorphins, feel-good chemicals, are also released. So it's true when you hear someone say, I just needed a good cry. I often use EMDR, which I'll be talking about shortly, to help partners release stuck, unprocessed grief and loss. Grounding exercises to decrease stress and be in the here and now. Dialectical Behavior Therapy, DBT, focuses on helping to build skills in distress tolerance, emotional regulation, and interpersonal effectiveness. There's a great list of self-care activities found in the Dialectical Behavioral Therapy Skills Workbook. Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, CBT, focuses on changing negative beliefs and thought patterns that often cause depression and anxiety. Trauma Egg, An exercise that gives space to acknowledge painful events from birth to the present day that are difficult to talk about. As we see these events on paper, we can begin to identify our trauma-induced shame beliefs that resulted from those events. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR. We've all experienced being vulnerable to stressful or unexpected painful events to some degree in our lives. EMDR focuses on helping the brain get unstuck from the negative shame beliefs and emotions that get stored in the mind and leave us with low self-esteem, anxiety, fears, and depression. It does this by helping the brain safely resolve distressing memories and replace them with more honoring, truthful conclusions about ourselves, giving us a stronger sense of who we are. Not only does EMDR help to change our beliefs, but because we are releasing what has been stuck in our minds, our bodies and brains also begin to quiet down. By processing emotionally charged memories and their triggering shame beliefs, EMDR can help reduce anxiety, lift depression, and quiet ruminating thoughts. I suggest people find a certified or consultant-level trained EMDR clinician at emdria.org. Group therapy. Support groups create safe alliances for care, shared experiences, and empathy. Women who receive helpful support after betrayal report less symptoms of post-traumatic stress. Music therapy. Listening to music can help to regulate our moods, help us release and reconnect with our emotions, reduce heart rate and blood pressure, lower cholesterol levels, and decrease anxiety and stress. In fact, there is research that music and singing help us to slow down, relax, and even smile. Art therapy. Researchers have found that using art, crayons, paints, sketching, sculpting, etc., to reconnect bodies, emotions, and thoughts around speechless experiences helps those with PTSD heal. Pharmacotherapy. Because of the enduring nature of recovery and repeated discoveries, psychotropic medications or natural supplements can be a helpful element for brain support during longer-term stress symptoms caused by sex addiction-induced trauma. Brain state technology. Brainwave optimization is a holistic, non-invasive form of neurotechnology that helps our brains guide themselves to improve relaxation and increase flexibility so that we can experience deeper sleep, increase calm, mental clarity, and increase emotional resources to help us stand up under stress. Kara came to see me after she found herself suffering from debilitating sleep issues, anxiety, overwhelming sadness, and a constant barrage of negative flashbacks from her husband's porn addiction and affairs. I talked with Kara about how her brain might be traumatically stuck in a place and referred her to one of my colleagues for an assessment. The evaluation showed overactivity in areas of her brain responsible for processing emotions. Much like a soldier who is repeatedly deployed to the battlefield, Kara realized her continued discoveries of her husband's sex addiction kept her brain in a vigilant state of alarm. Her brain got stuck in a stress response without relief, and eventually it collapsed from exhaustion. Kara said, "It's a horrible thing to have your brain take you hostage and then not be able to do the simplest of tasks. My inner world felt scrambled, and I couldn't figure out what to do." After Kara went through brainwave optimization, she was able to sleep and began resourcing her options. "My mind is working again, so I'm better able to figure out what I need to do." Self-care encompasses your body, brain, and new ways of being. As Kara discovered, taking care of yourself helps you live again. Chapter 19, A Change of Heart. Two large SUVs and a pickup truck sat in the driveway and five of my closest friends loaded boxes, books, and lampshades into their vehicles while the rain relentlessly poured down. The cloudburst seemed fitting. I was moving out of the first home we had owned together. Wet sweatshirts and somber glances in the hallway made this move a woeful act of mercy. These were loyal friends and fighters who had prayed for Connor and me, hoping we'd turn things around. Instead, articles were removed piece by piece, leaving dust bunnies and faint indentations in the carpet where furniture once stood. Our dog Bailey loved the commotion and company. He ran in and out of the house, weaved around legs, and jumped into cars. Every moment I could, I bent down to hug him. I couldn't get enough. I wrapped my arms around his chest as he flopped down in my lap. My heart broke. He looked up and he saw the tears on my face. My mind floated back to the day I brought Bailey home and surprised Connor with a puppy for Christmas. I was facing the painful reality that Bailey couldn't come with me. This time, he wouldn't be going for a ride in my car. Before we left, I grabbed a few linens I would need for my new place. As I reached up to the top shelf of our hall closet, I was surprised to find a basin and two small towels, something I'd last seen on our honeymoon night. My mind recalled the day I had a jeweler etch a verse from Philippians 2 about loving and serving one another inside Connor's wedding band. As a living expression of what I engraved, I had packed these towels and a water basin to use on our honeymoon night so we could wash each other's feet before we made love. It was a simple and beautiful gesture. Understated, warmly received, sacred. It was my hope to continue this tradition each year on our anniversary as a way of renewing our intentions. When pornography came into our marriage within the first 6 months, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't hold on to this sacred tradition and honor myself at the same time. One big yes. After we finished the move, I knew I needed to come back to our house one last time. I remembered seeing dust bunnies and wanted to quickly run a vacuum through the house. It was a crazy thought, but I didn't want Connor walking into the mess. As I passed the dining room, I saw Bailey's muddied paw prints on the hardwood floor. Getting down on my knees with a bucket of hot soapy water and wash rag in hand, I began to clean the floor. My rumbling started. Connor has no idea what I'm doing right now. He doesn't deserve this. Flashes of women raced through my mind. Years of porn, phone sex, the affairs, more lies, the prostitute. What's wrong with me? Why am I mopping the floor? As clear as a bell, I heard in my mind, "Beloved, you're washing his feet." I froze. I couldn't move, and then something burst up from within me. I wailed. My hands were in a bucket of muddy water. I knew what this meant. How could God break through so kindly, so purely to remind me of my sacred intention? How could that message come amidst my sludge of bitterness and loss? My wedding night, my unfulfilled wish, a longing I had put to death. In those tear-filled moments, something inside me shifted. It's as if I found space in my chest to breathe. Deep inside this place was a grace offering towards Connor. Up until that time, my justifiable resentments had me in a vice grip. This was my first step towards letting go and unburdening myself from the vitriolic acid inside. Connor hadn't changed. And after several years of fighting for him, I was walking away from a failed marriage. In a moment that felt like mopping up defeat, I was able to say yes and took a step towards forgiving Connor. Crazy, unexplainable, and miraculous at the same time. Paula Reinhart says it best in Strong Women, Soft Hearts.